Chapter 43. That morning, during the drive, he was silent. Anthony was the last man to condemn conventionally any human being, to scorn and despise even deserved misfortune. He was ready to take old DeBarrel the convict on his daughter's valuation without the slightest reserve. But love like his, though it may drive one into risky folly by the proud consciousness of its own strength, has a sagacity of its own. And now, as if lifted up into a higher and serene region by its purpose of renunciation, it gave him leisure to reflect for the first time in these last few days. He said to himself, "Don't know that man. She does not know him either. She was barely 16 when they locked him up. She was a child. What will he say? What will he do? No," he concluded, "I cannot leave her behind with that man who would come into the world as if out of a grave." They went on board in silence, and it was after showing her round, and when they had returned to the saloon, that he assailed her in his fiery, masterful fashion. At first she did not understand. Then when she understood that he was giving her her liberty, she went stiff all over, her hand resting on the edge of the table, her face set like a carving of white marble. It was all over. It was as that abominable governess had said. She was insignificant, contemptible. Nobody could love her. Humiliation clung to her like a cold shroud never to be shaken off, unwarmed by this madness of generosity. "Yes. Here. Your home. I can't give it to you and go away, but it is big enough for us too. You need not be afraid. If you say so, I shall not even look at you. Remember that gray head of which you have been thinking night and day. Where is it going to rest? Where else if not here, where nothing evil can touch it? Don't you understand that I won't let you buy shelter from me at the cost of your very soul? I won't. You are too much part of me. I have found myself since I came upon you, and I would rather sell my own soul to the devil than let you go out of my keeping. But I must have the right." He went away brusquely to shut the door leading on deck, and came back the whole length of the cabin repeating, "I must have the legal right. Are you ashamed of letting people think you are my wife?" He opened his arms, as if to clasp her to his breast, but mastered the impulse, and shook his clenched hands at her, repeating, "Must have the right if only for your father's sake. I must have the right. Where would you take him? To that infernal cardboard box maker. I don't know what keeps me from hunting him up in his virtuous home and bashing his head in. I can't bear the thought. Listen to me, Flora. Do you hear what I am saying to you? You are not so proud that you can't understand that I as a man have my pride too?" He saw a tear glide down her white cheek from under each lowered eyelid. Then, abruptly, she walked out of the cabin. He stood for a moment, concentrated, reckoning his own strength, interrogating his heart, before he followed her hastily. Already as he had reached the wharf, at the sound of his pursuing footsteps her strength failed her. Where could she escape from this? From this new perfidy of life taking upon itself the form of magnanimity. His very voice was changed. The sustaining whirlwind had let her down, to stumble on again, weakened by the fresh stab, bereft of moral support which is wanted in life more than all the charities of material help. She had never had it. Never. Not from the fines. But where to go? Oh yes, this dock, a placid sheet of water close at hand. But there was that old man with whom as he had walked hand in hand on the parade by the sea. She seemed to see him coming to meet her, pitiful, a little grayer, with an appealing look and an extended, tremulous arm. It was for her now to take the hand of that wronged man more helpless than a child. But where could she lead him? Where? And what was she to say to him? What words of cheer, of courage and of hope? There were none. Heaven and earth were mute, unconcerned at their meeting. But this other man was coming up behind her. He was very close now. His fiery person seemed to radiate heat, a tingling vibration into the atmosphere. She was exhausted. careless, afraid to stumble, ready to fall. She fancied she could hear his breathing. A wave of languid warmth overtook her. She seemed to lose touch with the ground under her feet, and when she felt him slip his hand under her arm, she made no attempt to disengage herself from that grasp which closed upon her limb, insinuating and firm. He conducted her through the dangers of the quayside. Her sight was dim. A moving truck was like a mountain gliding by. Men passed by, as if in a mist, and the buildings, the sheds, the unexpected open spaces, the ships, had strange, distorted, dangerous shapes. She said to herself that it was good not to be bothered with what all these things meant in the scheme of creation, if indeed anything had a meaning, or were just piled up matter without any sense. She felt how as he had always been unrelated to this world. She was hanging on to it merely by that one arm grasped firmly just above the elbow. It was a captivity. So be it. Till they got out into the street, and saw the hansom waiting outside the gates, Anthony spoke only once, beginning brusquely but in a much gentler tone than as he had ever heard from his lips. "Of course I ought to have known that you could not care for a man like me, a stranger. Silence gives consent. Yes? Eh? I don't want any of that sort of consent. And unless someday you find you can speak. No. No. I shall never ask you. For all the sign I will give you, you may go to your grave with sealed lips. But what I have said you must do." He bent his head over her with tender care. At the same time she felt her arm pressed and shaken inconspicuously, but in an undeniable manner. "You must do it." A little shake, that no passerby could notice, and this was going on in a deserted part of the dock. Tea must be done. "You are listening to me, eh? Or would you go again to my sister?" His ironic tone, perhaps from want of use, had an awful grating ferocity. "Would you go to her?" he pursued in the same strange voice. "Our best friend. And say nicely I am sorry. Would you?" "No. You couldn't. There are things that even you, poor dear lost girl, couldn't stand. Eh? Die rather. That's it. Of course. Or can you be thinking of taking your father to that infernal cousin's house? No. Don't speak. I can't bear to think of it. I would follow you there and smash the door." The catch in his voice astonished her by its resemblance to a sob. It frightened her too. The thought that came to her head was, "He mustn't. He was putting her into the hansom. H. He mustn't, he mustn't." She was still more frightened by the discovery that he was shaking all over. Bewildered, shrinking into the far-off corner, avoiding his eyes, she yet saw the quivering of his mouth, and made a wild attempt at a smile, which broke the rigidity of her lips, and set her teeth chattering suddenly. "I am not coming with you," he was saying. "LL tell the man. I can't. Better not. What is it? Are you cold? Come. What is it? Only to go to a confounded stuffy room, a hole of an office. Not a quarter of an hour. I'll come for you in 10 days. Don't think of it too much. Think of no man, woman, or child of all that silly crowd cumbering the ground. Don't think of me either. Think of yourself. Ha! Nothing will be able to touch you then at last. Say nothing. Don't move. I'll have everything arranged. And as long as you don't hate the sight of me, and you don't, there's nothing to be frightened about. One of their silly offices with a couple of inkslingers of no consequence. Poor, scribbling devils." The hansom drove away with Florida Barrel inside, without movement, without thought, only too glad to rest, to be alone, and still moving away without effort, in solitude and silence. Anthony roamed the streets for hours without being able to remember any evening where he had been in the manner of a happy and exulting lover. But nobody could have thought so from his face, which bore no signs of blissful anticipation. Exulting indeed he was, but it was a special sort of exultation which seemed to take him by the throat like an enemy. Anthony's last words to Flora referred to the registry office, where they were married 10 days later. During that time Anthony saw no one or anything, though he went about restlessly, here and there, amongst men and things. This special state is peculiar to common lovers, who are known to have no eyes for anything except for the contemplation, actual or inward, of one human form which for them contains the soul of the whole world in all its beauty, perfection, variety, and infinity. It must be extremely pleasant. But felicity was denied to Roderick Anthony's contemplation. He was not a common sort of lover, and he was punished for it, as if nature, which it is said abhors a vacuum, were so very conventional as to abhor every sort of exceptional conduct. Roderick Anthony had begun already to suffer. That is why perhaps he was so industrious in going about amongst his fellow men, who would have been surprised and humiliated, had they known how little solidity and even existence they had in his eyes. But they could not suspect anything so queer. They saw nothing extraordinary in him during that fortnight. The proof of this is that they were willing to transact business with him. Obviously they were, since it is then that the offer of chartering his ship for the special purpose of proceeding to the Western Islands was put in his way by a firm of shipbrokers who had no doubt of his sanity. He probably looked sane enough for all the practical purposes of commercial life. But I am not so certain that he really was quite sane at that time. However, he jumped at the offer. Providence itself was offering him this opportunity to accustom the girl to sea life by a comparatively short trip. This was the time when everything that happened, everything he heard, casual words, unrelated phrases, seemed a provocation or an encouragement, confirmed him in his resolution. And indeed, to be busy with material affairs is the best preservative against reflection, fears, doubts, all these things which stand in the way of achievement. I suppose a fellow proposing to cut his throat would experience a sort of relief while occupied in stropping his razor carefully. And Anthony was extremely careful in preparing for himself and for the luckless Flora an impossible existence. He went about it with no more tremors than if he had been stuffed with racks or made of iron instead of flesh and blood. An existence, mind you, which, on shore, in the thick of mankind, of varied interests, of distractions, of infinite opportunities to preserve your distance from each other, is hardly conceivable. But on board ship, at sea, NTDT for days and weeks and months together, could mean nothing but mental torture, an exquisite absurdity of torment. He was a simple soul. His hopelessly masculine ingenuousness is displayed in a touching way by his care to procure some woman to attend on Flora. The condition of guaranteed perfect respectability gave him moments of anxious thought. When he remembered suddenly his steward's wife, he must have exclaimed Eureka with particular exultation. One does not like to call Anthony an ass. But really, to put any woman within scenting distance of such a secret and suppose that she would not track it out. No woman, however simple, could be as ingenuous as that. I don't know how Flora de Barrel qualified him in her thoughts when he told her of having done this amongst other things intended to make her comfortable. I should think that, for all her simplicity, she must have been appalled. He stood before her on the appointed day outwardly calmer than as he had ever seen him before. And this very calmness, that scrupulous attitude which he felt bound in honor to assume then and forever, unless she would condescend to make a sign at some future time, added to the heaviness of her heart innocent of the most pardonable guile. The night before as he had slept better than as he had done for the past 10 nights. Both youth and weariness will assert themselves in the end against the tyranny of nerve-racking stress. As he had slept, but she woke up with her eyes full of tears. There were no traces of them when she met him in the shabby little parlor downstairs. She had swallowed them up. She was not going to let him see. She felt bound in honor to accept the situation forever and ever unless... unless... She dissembled all her sentiments, but it was not duplicity on her part. All she wanted was to get at the truth, to see what would come of it. She beat him at his own honorable game, and the thoroughness of her serenity disconcerted Anthony a bit. It was he who stammered when it came to talking. The suppressed fierceness of his character carried him on after the first word or two masterfully enough. But it was as if they both had taken a bite of the same bitter fruit. He was thinking with mournful regret not unmixed with surprise. That fellow Fine has been telling me the truth. She does not care for me a bit. It humiliated him, and also increased his compassion for the girl who in this darkness of life, buffeted and despairing, had fallen into the grip of his stronger will, abandoning herself to his arms, as on a night of shipwreck. Flora on her side with partial insight, for women are never blind with a complete masculine blindness, looked on him with some pity, and she felt pity for herself too. It was a rejection, a casting out, nothing new to her. But she who supposed all her sensibility dead by this time, discovered in herself a resentment of this ultimate betrayal. She had no resignation for this one. With a sort of mental sullenness she said to herself, "L, I am here. I am here without any nonsense. It is not my fault that I am a mere worthless object of pity." And these things which she could tell herself with a clear conscience, served her better than the passionate obstinacy of purpose could serve Roderick Anthony. She was much more sure of herself than he was. Such are the advantages of mere rectitude over the most exalted generosity. And so they went out to get married, the people of the house where she lodged, having no suspicion of anything of the sort. They were only excited at a gentleman friend, a very fine man too, calling on Miss Smith for the first time since he had come to live in the house. When she returned, for she did come back alone, there were allusions made to that outing. He had to take her meals with these rather vulgar people. The woman of the house, a scraggy, genteel person, tried even to provoke confidences. Flora's white face with the deep blue eyes did not strike their hearts as it did the heart of Captain Anthony, as the very face of the suffering world. Her pained reserve had no power to awe them into decency. Well, she returned alone as in fact might have been expected. After leaving the registry office, Flora DeBarrel and Roderick Anthony had gone for a walk in a park. It must have been an East End park, but I am not sure. Anyway, that's what they did. It was a sunny day. He said to her, "Everything I have in the world belongs to you. I have seen to that without troubling my brother-in-law. They have no call to interfere." She walked with her hand resting lightly on his arm. He had offered it to her on coming out of the registry office, and he had accepted it silently. Her head drooped. She seemed to be turning matters over in her mind. She said, alluding to the Fines, "They have been very good to me." At that he exclaimed, "They have never understood you." "Well, not properly. My sister is not a bad woman, but..." Flora didn't protest, asking herself whether he imagined that he himself understood her so much better. Anthony, dismissing his family out of his thoughts, went on, "Everything is yours. I have kept nothing back. As to the piece of paper we have just got from that miserable quill driver, if it wasn't for the law, I wouldn't mind if you tore it up here now, on this spot. But don't you do it. Unless you should someday feel that..." He choked, unexpectedly. She, reflective, hesitated a moment, then making up her mind bravely, "Neither am I keeping anything back from you." He had said it. But he in his blind generosity assumed that she... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.